Well, good morning, everybody. I'm M.A. Barnes, and I'm an alcoholic. Oh, well, I'm glad to see you all here. You all made it through the dance. We made it through the weekend. Hasn't this been a weekend? Hasn't this been something wonderful? I just feel so full and so rich. I've heard the speakers, and I've made friends. It's amazing how we all touch each other's lives, and you become a part of my life, and I become a part of your life, and we all go away so much richer and stronger and better than we've ever been before every time our lives touch. Something wonderful happens. And this weekend has just been wonderful. I got to see my sponsor, Clancy. He gave me the business like he always does. Clancy's been my sponsor almost 9 years of my almost 14 years of sobriety. Women don't often have men sponsors, as you know. But my then sponsor, Colleen Whalen, in California, was very ill. And she was turning all of her pigeons over because she couldn't sponsor us anymore. She died shortly thereafter. And she was kind of suggesting who people should get as their sponsors. And when she came to me, she said, I think, M.A., for you, you better go get Clancy. And I said, Clancy? I was just terrified of Clancy. And she said, that's why. She said, you better have something in your life that, you know, that will stop you and pull you up short. I always think of myself as a wimp. I think of myself as a real sissy, big emotional slob, you know. I cry easy and all that. I guess I'm not, you know, and I think that's kind of what a sponsor is sometimes. I think I'm very strong-willed, and I needed a sponsor like Clancy. And I went to Clancy and asked him to be my sponsor, and he has a deal. You know, you don't argue with him ever. If you want what he has, you do what he says. And that's hard for me, and I think that's probably why Colleen suggested that. Because I have to have always done what Clancy told me to do, and here I am 9 years later. And I'm still sober, and I'm happy, and I'm working, and I'm a productive member of society, and as pig-headed as I guess I am, I've loved that man with my whole heart for a long, long time. And what he says goes, I remember one time I was trying to sell him on some idea. I even knew when I called him it was a lousy idea, but I thought I could maybe sell him on it. And so I was telling him, and I was really selling. Boy, I was in there just selling. Say, boy, we've got to do this and that and this other thing. And there was this silence on the other end of the phone, and he said, I think that's a wonderful idea, and you should tell your new sponsor all about it. And he hung up. I called him back. Well, I guess it wasn't such a wonderful idea after all. But it was wonderful to see him. I try to go out to his birthday every year in California. I got sober in California, in Laguna Beach, California. And you always think where you get sober, it's the best place in the whole wide world to get sober. I remember Clancy said about Laguna Beach one time, he said going to AA in Laguna Beach was like going through a sewer in a glass-bottom boat. Isn't that funny? But anyway, it was to me wonderful, and I had the very great fortune of getting sober in Chuxie's living room. The longer I'm sober and the longer I live, the more I realize just what a great, great gift that was to me. He is so much a part of my life. I still listen to his tapes over and over and over. Some of it I still don't get, but that was great for me when I found out I was going to be the spiritual speaker. Clancy was supposed to be the spiritual speaker, and we had to switch. I should have had this all over with by Friday, and then I could have relaxed a little more. I found out I was going to be the spiritual speaker. I thought, well, I better get spiritual quick. Don't have much time. And I was thinking about Chuck. I often spend a lot of time thinking about him. I remember when he died, I thought I wasn't going to make it. And John C. was sitting in his living room when I went up there, and he said, if you think Chuck's gone, you didn't hear a word he said. He said, just because you can't see him doesn't mean he's gone. He's just in another room, and he's as much a part of us as he's ever been. He still, you know, lives with us. And that helped me a lot. And he helped me with the spirituality of it, too, because I've never, when I came in here, prior to coming in here, as so many of us, I was afraid of God. I was raised a Southern Baptist. I was, again, I don't know that's what was said, but what I heard was that God was going to get me. That my friend Mary Reagan says, she said, maybe I don't walk like I talk, but at least I don't walk like I think. And I like that because when I came here, I the way I thought and the way I still think, my thinking is kind of skewed. And even as a young person, I always thought that God was going to get me and that I'd had it and I was washed up and I was going to hell and there was no way out of it because of the way I thought. And I couldn't stop thinking the way I thought. I always had this some sort of wry, sort of skewed up sexual messed up thing. Even in church, you know, I would have that. And so I was always afraid that I was born struck out. And Chuck C. Helped me so much in that. I remember there was a story that he used to tell. We spend so much time seeking God and looking for God and talking to God and praying to God. And I join in with the best of them in those discussions. And Chuck used to tell a story about the three little fishes that were swimming around in the water one day and just having a wonderful time. It's a beautiful day. And big fish came swimming along, and he looked at him and he said, "Hi, fellas." He said, "Isn't the water wonderful today?" And he swam off. And the three little fishes looked at each other and they said, "Water? What's water?" And they rushed off in search of water in which they lived and moved and had their being. And that to me just said so much, because that to me is God. You know, what we're looking for is what we're looking with. That was another one of Chuck's I've worked on for a few years. Because God is everything. You know, God is that in which we live and move and have our being. And that helped me so much with everything and the loving God concept too. So that's the spiritual part of my talk. That's the best I can do. Borrowed. but that did make me feel so much better that, you know, God is everything. Chuck used to say, too, he said that he was, you know, he's been accused of being a water walker because he was overboard on the spiritual, so-called. And he always said, but I'm one of those who knows that everything is spiritual. Everything we do is spiritual. Our being here is spiritual. He used to say there's nothing more spiritual than a ham sandwich when you're hungry. All those kinds of things always made sense to me. So, anyway, that was the spiritual message I had. Being here with all this sobriety and all these big speakers, I just have to tell my old story. This is the way that I go about it, because that is my experience, strength, and hope that I'm here and that I'm proud to be here. It's such a privilege to be asked to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the committee for taking such good care of me. Well, I've been indulged this weekend with fruit bowls in the room and everything and all that because I was a real bad drunk and real mouthy and got in a lot of trouble. And for that, you know, I get to come here and be part of your lives. And I want to thank everyone who asked me to be here. It's always a privilege. Privilege to be anywhere, as everyone says. I was raised a Southern Baptist and born struck out, and our family never talked about anything. And I know that seems to be another common thread that runs in between all of us. I was always very ashamed of what I felt and ashamed of what I thought. And it was never a welcome thing to hear about it in my family, about what went on in the family. And you certainly never talked about anything outside the family. It was a terrible, great shame to admit that there was a problem in the family. Everyone said, "You're just fine," and "Everybody's fine." And I learned very early on on the few times that I would try to talk about what was going on or what I was feeling, it was always met with a lot of resistance about, "Oh my God, don't talk about that. Oh, you know." Anytime outside the family, I used to be told, "You know, you don't ever take these things outside the family. You know, it was a disgrace." In my family, my mother was not a Southerner. Everybody in the family was a Southerner, and she was not. And, you know, her whole life, she was never really a part of that family. And there was always this worry that not being a Southerner, you didn't know about her background, and you didn't know about her, what she was going to turn out to be. Now, this is a long time ago, but that was kind of the way it was, and it kind of proved itself in the family's mind, because my mother became an alcoholic, and my mother died an alcoholic, and all these new deals that are coming up, you know, with ACA and all those things. I was always going to start my own group called the Daughters of Alcoholic Mothers, and you can call it DAM. It sounds like that's a possibility for things. My mother was alcoholic, and in the middle of all these thou shalt nots, and everyone just tried to be so perfect, and as long as you look good on the outside, you know, everything was okay. My mother was alcoholic and became more and more severely alcoholic, as we all do. Remember, I heard somebody saying being a little alcoholic is like being a little bit pregnant. It just doesn't show as much at the beginning as it does later on. And that was true of my alcoholism, too. And my mother's alcoholism progressed along. And she did all the things alcoholics do. And in a family that where you can't share and you can't talk about things, there was so much denial going on. Now, I learned these words later about denial and that sort of thing. I didn't know about denial at the time. I just knew that she just didn't talk about anything. And you held everything inside. I think one of the reasons I became a writer as a profession is because I had an outlet where I could talk about what I was feeling and what was going on. And I learned to play act. I think children learn to play act at a certain time. And I had my costumes. I always looked at my closet as my costumes. I had my church costume, and I had my play costume, and I had, you know, all these different costumes that I could put on and whatever, as long as I looked an outside job. As long as I looked okay, you know, I would feel okay. And in the church, I had a difficult time because everyone would, I knew what went on in the family, and there was the alcoholism, and there was the anger, and there was all these things going on, and yet we would go into church, and we'd wear our white gloves, and we would sit there, and we would all smile and say everything was just fine. And I used to look around and say, God, I wonder if everybody's buying this. You know, I wonder if they're really believing all this stuff, you know, because I knew that I didn't believe it, and I was worried, and I used to entertain myself. I said before about to, you know, I'd look at our preacher, and I'd think, God, I wonder if he ever does it. You know, I'd look at him, and I'd think, nah. Yeah, but he had two kids, you know. And then I'd look at his wife, and she was singing in the choir, and she was one of those used to sing that like a goat. She'd sing, hey, you know, and just sounded like the billy goat. And I used to look at them, and I used to wonder, I think, God, they had two kids. And I used to just smile, you know. I used to think that just must have looked so funny, you know. And my grandmother would look down, and she'd smile, and I'd fold my hands, and I'd smile back, you know. And, you know, it's just like beatific, you know, little child, you know. And I was never buying it. I used to write punchlines on the program, you know. There'd be scripture, and I'd write a punchline and just laugh, you know. You tickle me to death, you know. And, you know, I always kept these things inside, you know. I used to look at everybody and wonder what the crowd looked like naked, you know. I still do that. It's a great crowd today. Checking y'all out. With a mind like that, it's tough, you know, going on. And there's a lot of agony behind all of that, too, you know, because I always felt so different. You know, I've heard everybody here say that you feel so different than I did. I always felt like I didn't fit. Someone said I felt like I was just kind of a little bit outside of everything that was going on. You know, I observed it. I took place in it. I dressed to put on my costume. I was right in the middle of taking part of it. But I always felt like I was looking around to see, you know, if everybody was in on the joke, you know, or something, you know, if everyone, you know, understood these things. So that was kind of my background. I went off into life and was raised you know, to be very proper, and I wasn't proper, and I knew I wasn't proper. And when you know that, you know you aren't good, and you aren't good enough. Clancy talked about that. You don't quite measure up somehow. And I did have a wild hair. I don't know how many of you have had that. I had this sense of madness. I don't know what the dickens it was. I always had to know what was over the next hill, and what would happen if, and if I said this, what would people do? And if I did that, this shocking thing, upset the apple cart just to see what would happen, you know, and just stand back and watch and see what would go on. And there was a play called The Fantastics. I don't know how many of you have seen it. I saw that years and years ago. And there was one part where the young man, he has to leave, and he's dreaming about what's over that next hill. You know, what are those lights over the hill? He had to get up and go as the young man. And I identified with that. And the narrator always says, those lights not only glitter, but once you get there, they burn. And he kept saying, I can learn. Let me learn, you know. And I really identified with that boy. I just swelled up inside, you know, when they would sing that song, because that was my story. I had to go over the hill and learn. And I had, you know, huge inferiorities also. The family was very lovely and very beautiful. I have an aunt that was a Miss Georgia and this kind of thing. And I was always kind of goofy, the goofy one of the bunch, the funny one, the bright one. I remember I was an eavesdropper, too, among other things. I was always... Serves you right what you find out if you eavesdrop, but I did. And I remember my dad saying one time of me, and he was talking to the family, and he says, it's sure a good thing she's bright, because she isn't pretty and she's never going to get married. You know, and it's funny how we live by other people's indictments. I learned that here, too, that so often people have said things about me and me not having any idea who I was. I would hear that and I would think, well, they must know, because I never, you know, knew who I was. I had no clear picture of who I was or where I was going or what my talents were. And so I remembered that so very clearly, because I thought, well, hell with them. You know, I'll be bright. You know, I kind of always had this thing in my mind. I really wanted to be married, and I wanted to do all the things that my aunts did and have a pie baking on the windowsill. I had all these, I'm a little bit dramatic, you know, sense of the drama. I went to a lot of movies. And I always had that image of it, but I couldn't sustain those images. You know, I could always get it all together and make it look okay, but I couldn't sustain it over the long run. So I thought, well, nuts to him. I don't care. I'll just go off to college. And when I did go off to college, everyone else got married and I went off to school. And, well, I'll tell you, I loved it. I just loved it. It was the first time where I could break loose. You know, I didn't have any of these restrictions anymore. You know, and I went crazy. I just had a wonderful time. I discovered all the thou shalt nots, you know, that I was not supposed to do. You know, I was even Someone was talking about Catholics the other night. I was always told to be very careful of Catholics. They were just dreadful people, you know. I found out there's an awful lot of Catholics, an awful lot of Baptists in this program, you know. Come find out we're an awful lot alike. But I thought surely I should go off and meet some Catholics because they must be disgraceful people. I didn't have any idea what they were, what it was about. I did that. This was before television, too. Remember, we didn't have the homogenization that we have now, and I had all these images of how things were. So I went off to college, and I did very well in school, and I learned to drink, and I learned to smoke cigarettes, and I learned to dance, and I learned to go out with guys, and I learned to do a lot of things, and I had so many inhibitions. Someone else said this weekend that there's a real stuffed shirt in all of us. There's a real puritanical streak in all of us, and there is in me today. I amaze myself what a stuffed shirt I can be. But when I had a little bit of alcohol, boy, it just killed that puritanical in me. And I was a wild hair, I tell you. You know, I would, if I could think of it, I'd do it. You know, and I had an active imagination, and I would do it. You know, and it seemed to me like I'd already paid the price for it, because it seemed like I had gotten punished for so many things I didn't do. I thought, well, hell, I'm going to just do it all. I'm just going to do whatever I can think of, I'm going to do it, because I've already been punished for it. And I kind of thought I was struck out anyway. You know, God didn't want anything to do with me, so... You know, what was there to lose? You know, so I just went ahead and did the things that I thought of. And joined a sorority and started writing for a living. And started writing at the time. There used to be a lot of things called True Story and My Story and Love Story and all these kinds of books. And so I had really not much experience with it. I was never, you know, very terribly popular in school. I didn't do that much. I stayed home, you know, and thought about things more than did them. So I started writing all these love stories, you know, and all this. And I thought they were very tender and very emotional love stories. There were a lot of fantasy and things. And I wrote under M.A. And the editors wrote back and they said, you have a very feminine flair to your work, Mr. Hancock was my maiden name, you know. They thought I was a guy. And they said, you have such a nice feminine flair to your work. Why don't you spice these things up a little bit, you know, and start... So I started writing what was at that time porno, you know, with absolutely, really, now I read some porno recently and that stuff's disgraceful. That was awful. Mine was really kind of sexy. I mean, when you have nothing to do on a Saturday night and you're sitting writing, you know, and you know, some of the stuff, I think, actually, I wonder if that would work, you know, and so I'd write it. I figured if it didn't work, they'd say so. So I always had a creative mind and, you know, so this is the way I kind of earned my living when I was in school, and there was something about me just loved that. There was... Here I was drinking and I was smoking and I was getting away with something. I don't know how many people like to break the rules, but I sure did like to break the rules, you know, and I used to think, wouldn't my family just die, you know, if they knew, you know, because it was always had my secret life going, always over here, you know, because it was like I couldn't be who I was. I had to have a secret life over here and a public life over here. To put the two together, if anyone knew about those lives, I would be so unacceptable to everyone. So I just... You know, enjoyed that sort of thing. Drinking was never normal with me, and I know that now. I didn't know it then. I never wanted to become an alcoholic because of my mother, and I did not want to be like her. And like you've heard a zillion times, guess what? You know, I became more and more like her as time went on. It says something about in the Bible, that which we focus on, that we shall become. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. And a man thinks in himself become the things he thinks about. There's a lot of references to that sort of thing that I have learned over the time. And in so wanting not to be like my mother, I very slowly became more and more like her. But the drinking was, when I would go out, I would drink all I could drink. I mean, isn't that what you do? I knew people who drank one, and I think, well, why would you bother going out? You know, if you just, you know, if you're not going to do it, just don't do it. You know, if you're going to do it, do it. And I would always drink too much, and I blacked out in the beginning. And I thought everyone blacked out. I thought if you drank a certain amount, you blacked out. I mean, it seemed normal to me. And I always drank way past everybody else, and I drank till everybody went home or till I ran out of money. And that, to me, that was perfectly normal. That's what you did. You're going to drink, you drink. I didn't have too much trouble with it, though. I guess in my own mind, I didn't have too much trouble with it. And I went on through school and did this bit of drinking, and then I got married. Ha-ha, I showed them. I married a Yankee. And I had two sons, and, you know, there was a part of me that really wanted this to be just right. You know, there's always this very conservative side of me, this proper side. And I wanted to have the marriage perfect. And I did everything I did. Once again, went back into my play acting thing. You know, I bought the sexy underwear, and I had two sons, and I cleaned the house, and I baked the pies, and I did all these things. And it wasn't working. You know, it wasn't... I had to go over that hill one more time. There was always something light shining out there that I had to go to. This was not a fulfilling thing to me. And I continued writing all this time, too. I was writing greeting cards by this time, and I was writing for about 27 companies. And I was at home writing, while I was raising the children. And finally, I thought, you know, this marriage just isn't working. It's not right. So I really, the drinking story, I suppose, begins when I moved to Cleveland. I took my two sons and I moved to Cleveland, got a divorce, and went to work full time as an editor of a greeting card company there. And I fell in with a very jovial crowd, frisky bunch in there, a bunch of artists and writers and forward thinkers, and also fell in love, unquote. Obsession, possession, and manipulation might be what I'd call it today, but boy, at the time it was love. I'll tell you, it was a whopper. And just fell madly in love with this man who was sometimes my boss and sometimes not, because we were in the same corporation. And we went to work and we made a lot of money for the company. And then we created a comic strip together, and we made a lot of money with that too. And we were just very successful together. He was an artist and I was a writer. And we had a daughter. My daughter will be 21 next month, and I can hardly believe it. But we were going to get married, but he already was. I told you I was bright. This only went on, and I can't remember how long it went on. I sit and try to remember sometimes. Somewhere between 9 and 14 years. I'm a little fuzzy in there because I did a little bit of drinking. And I'm not sure who quit or where it quit or where it stopped or what it was, but it went on for a very long time, and it was one of those just insane relationships. They're writing books about them at the time. At the time, I'd never experienced anything like that. There wasn't so many books about those kinds of madness, you know, that went on, as went on in that relationship. But it was an awful lot of drinking. I could not see that I had a problem with my drinking because he drank as much as I did. And in my opinion, I was just helping him. I was just with him. You know, I was trying to stop him from drinking. And he got very hostile and very angry when he drank. He was very mean. I didn't think I did. I thought I was being reasonable. And most of the things I did, it was very clear to me that he made me do it. You know, that was my cry. You know, when I would do something just absolutely dreadful, my very first thought was, oh, my God, look what he made me do now. You know, when I would behave badly, you know, look what he made me do. And it was, I've always walked around being so independent, acting, and all that. And it was really amazing how much of my own personality started disappearing in getting this man's approval. He defined who I was, and I didn't know this. You know, like alcoholism snuck up on me. Those kinds of things snuck up on me, too. I didn't realize how much of me was just disappearing into needing his approval so badly and so on. My two sons were doing wonderfully well. They were swimmers. And I was working, and I started moving up in this corporation and getting very successful. And I liked the drama and the excitement of business. But along with this business came a lot of drinking. And we would go out for lunch, and we would drink, and we would go to dinner, and we would drink, and then we would have dinner, drinks after dinner, and then we would drink, and then we'd sit in Saturday afternoon, and we would drink. And being with artists and writers, they smoked a lot of pot. Well, it never occurred to me that was really a drug. I mean, that was just kind of, you know, for fun. You smoke pot. I'm a little bit hyper, as I'm sure you can tell just by looking. And I had this heavy pressure job, and I was working full time, and I was trying to be Wonder Woman, as we do, and I was trying to run the Red Cross and the community chest on the one hand, and the other hand I'm drunk, you know, at night, and I'm, you know, trying to do all these things. It's very hard to keep all these plates spinning on top of all these sticks all the time. You know, you got to keep moving. And I would get very nervous, and so I went to my secretary one day and said, you know, you really should get some tranquilizers, because my hands were shaking so badly. It didn't occur to me that was alcoholism. I was shaking so badly, and she was right. Boy, what a good idea that was. I went to a doctor, and he gave me some tranquilizers, and so then I went to a psychologist, and he gave me tranquilizers, psychiatrist, I guess. Every doctor I went to gave me tranquilizers, so it was clear to me I needed tranquilizers. Doctors were kind of, you know, overreacting. They would take one every 4 hours, and, you know, if I was planning to be nervous that afternoon, I really had to get ready, you know, so I would take four every 1 hour or whatever, you know, just to get ready, and then I would get too ready, and then I would just be comatose by the time, you know, I was not nervous, but I was, you know, I couldn't function. So then someone, one of the artists, thank heavens for this, he said, what you need is speed. And he was right. That was exactly what I needed, you know, because when I would get too tranquil, then I would need some speed. If you can imagine me on speed, I talk faster than I can listen now, you know, and me on speed, and that was a great, great thing, but, you know, I could feel my heart. I used to, when I'd sit in meetings, I'd think my heart would pound, and I'd think, my God, people can see it, you know, and I would sit like this and then I couldn't sleep, so then you have to take sleeping pills, and all this time I was just drinking, you know, like mad, and trying so hard. You know, I really was trying hard. I was trying hard to do all these things and be all these things to people and live up to a lot of these ideals, because, you know, we are an idealistic bunch, and And I was, too, and I was trying to be idealistic. And yet, at the same time, sometimes I would just get fed up. I'd get fed up with the work, and I'd get fed up with the responsibilities of children all the time, and I had to have the biggest house, the biggest car. Like they were saying, I had to do more than everybody else just to feel even. And I think part of that had to do with alcoholism, in part because I was a woman, you know, and I had to do better than anybody else in order to feel even. And so I had all these things, and every now and then I would just get sick of it, and I would say, damn it, anyway, I deserve a little relaxation. And I would put on my jeans, I'd put on my cowboy hat, and I'd go up on Detroit Avenue in Cleveland, Boulevard of Broken Dreams, we used to call it, and go to these crappy, icky places. Oh, my God, they were just awful. And just kind of lose myself, you know, in all this madness and drinking and meeting all these real sleazebag people. Talk about, you know. And there was something wonderful again. You know, I would get away with it sometimes. And I was always the head of the marketing department. They were always my people that I took a lot of my anger out on. That when everybody would ask me my name, I'd tell them I was the wife of one of these marketing people and give them their phone number. So that these guys would be calling these marketing men's wives, you know, saying, "Hi, honey, I met you the other night." I used to go home and think, "Oh, isn't that funny?" You know, I said, "Oh." My little sneaky underhand way. Yeah, I'm getting at things. Things progressed, and things got worse. The money was coming in. I had an awful lot of the things that you need. I was taught, as you've heard so many times, that to be successful, you have to have money. To be successful, you have to have things. And from that standpoint, I was very successful. You know, I had a lot of money, and I had a lot of things. I remember reading one morning, it was in the Cleveland paper about me. They had done a story on me. I remember sitting in bed on a Sunday morning, and my children were all there, and they came and crawled in bed, and we were reading about me. About how successful I was and how I was able to juggle all these things and run all these organizations and do all these things. And here I was sitting in bed just hung over. Oh, God, I felt like my mind felt like burnt cat fur. I was just about to die, you know, and I was sick. And sitting there reading about this remarkable person in the magazine, and there was no relationship to what that person that I was written about, although those things are actually occurring. You know, you talk about schizophrenic, you know. Those things were what I was, but that's not what I was in my heart, because I just felt so, I was getting lonelier, and I was getting angrier, and I was getting more out of control. And I remember one particular evening, this man and I had been drinking, and here we were big executives in this company, and we came home, and I got mad, and I must have provoked him. Something I said, some little minor thing, I'm sure. And he was going around breaking out the windows in my house. And I thought that was hostile, so I got my son's aluminum baseball bat, and I went and remodeled his sports car with that baseball bat. And he came out, and he grabbed me, and I threw his keys, and he was swearing, and I was screaming, you know, and all this kind of thing. And I got hold of his face and scratched his face half off, you know. And this was just, you know, these big executives of this company behaving like this. This was kind of my example of social drinking. It was, looking back on that, seems out of control. I remember one of my sponsors one time said, "M.A., when will you ever learn to ask for what you want?" And I thought, "I'll be darned, that's an idea. I have never, what a concept." I never would have thought of that on my own. I remember that my way of dealing with things was like if someone slighted me a little bit, I would be angry, but I wouldn't say anything. So I'd kind of get them back somehow. I would just say some nasty, rotten, cutting remark. And then they would get very offended by this, and they would do something really lousy. So then I would be very offended by that, and I would do something lousier. And this thing would just escalate, you know, until I was breaking out windows and busting up sports cars with baseball bats and all this stuff. And I remember my sponsor said one time, maybe it was hard for this man to know that you were asking for a little tenderness and a little affection when you're remodeling his sports car like that. And it was really funny, but that I never occurred to me to ask for what I wanted, you know, because it was my feelings would get hurt. My feelings get hurt so easily, you know, that I would retaliate. I'd hit people with a frying pan rather than cry, you know. That was my method. And so I said that the drugs and the alcohol really propelled me into doing a lot of things that I ordinarily would not have done. As I said, my sons were swimmers, and at some point I moved to California. I knew that there was something real wrong with me. I was having whiteouts where I would be rushing. I was always in a hurry, and I was rushing. And I would have these whiteouts, and I didn't know where I was going. And I would have to stop by the side of the road and try to remember what day it was and where I was going. And I knew I was late, wherever it was, and somebody was mad somewhere if I could think of where it was. And this relationship was going to hell. You know, they say anything you pour alcohol on, it will dissolve. And that goes for relationships, too, I think. And I knew that what I had to do was get away. I've learned the word geographic came later. I had to get away. And so I went to California, and I knew it was the man, and I knew it was the job, and I knew it was the pressure, and I knew it was all of these things that I had to get away from. I mean, you had all that, you'd drink too. And I moved into a really nice Mission Viejo, California, is where I went to first, where the swimming is, and I got my kids and the sons in the swimming. And they became very successful as swimmers. My middle one made the Olympic team twice, and both my sons went off to Harvard, you know, and they that side of things looked so good. And yet what was going on with me, I realized when I went to California that my problem was portable. I had taken my problem with me, because when I got there, I had so much anger and so much resentment towards so much and so many things, and toward God and toward life, and nothing had done me right. And I took this problem with me, and I started to drink. I didn't have a drug connection out there in California. Never occurred to me that all those were drugs, and they were all going in me. You know, at one point in time, I used to read about people who OD'd on drugs and alcohol, and I used to think, my God, how much do they take, you know, to die from it, because I was taking it, you know, and I was up rocking around doing pretty good. I mean, all things considered, I was doing all right. But anyway, I finally had to shed all those responsibilities, and I went to California, and I had, you know, the writing contracts were there, and so I was able to support myself. But that's where it really hit me, that I just started to drink and drink and drink and drink. And in some sort of dramatic gesture, one day I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Actually, what had happened is my cousin, who had been alcoholic, used to call me when I lived in Cleveland, and I'd get these drunken phone calls in the middle of the night, you know, where she's going to kill herself or kill me or kill her husband, or, you know, just typical alcoholic phone calls like we do. And then I didn't hear from her for a while, a year maybe. And then she called me back, and she said, I've joined a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have an amend to make to you for all those phone calls. And, you know, at the time, I paid no attention to that phone call. I was saying, yeah, good. Well, I was glad she was sober. She was a pain in the behind, you know. I was saying, yeah, good, and I hung up. And several years later, I remembered that phone call, and I called her 3 o'clock in the morning, and I said, I think I have this problem. And she tells me I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't there, so I was always going to write a book called My Life is Seen Through the Eyes of Those Who Lived It. She tells me that I called Alcoholics Anonymous in this dramatic gesture. Then I realized I'd overreacted. I didn't really, really have a problem. You know, it was still this man. It was still all these other things. But I did go to AA, and I loved AA right off the bat. You know, I started to laugh, which I hadn't laughed in a long time, and I started thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if this really worked? I mean, really worked. Wouldn't it be great if there wasn't a catch to this? I knew somebody in a gray hat would show up and want me to tithe 20%. I know how this goes, you know. And I promised myself a big martini if I went to this stupid meeting, and I went to this stupid meeting, and I didn't have that martini, and it was really something. Another thing, too, that I guess God gives me very clear messages. I thought AA was, you know, Skid Row, like we all think, till we get here, you know. And I went to this meeting, looked about like this meeting. Everybody looked good. It was on a Sunday. Talk about blowing my image. I won't give away her anonymity, but a former First Lady of the United States called Betty F. was at that meeting, you know. And it really struck me, because no one was bugging her. Nobody was giving her. The woman I was with just happened to mention that was her over there, you know. And she was given the dignity to get sober in this program. And I thought, you know, there's really something going on here. No one was paying any more attention to her than anybody else. And that was a big lesson to me. I got sober, and I got a sponsor. And I didn't hear I wasn't supposed to take drugs. It doesn't mean it wasn't said. I didn't hear it. So I had quit drinking relatively easily, because I just kind of stepped up the pills. Until my sponsor was over one day, and she said, what are those pills you take? And I said, oh, it's nothing. It's tranquilizers, and it's sleeping pills and speed. And, you know, and I have all these medically indicated reasons to take all these things. I mean, I had all the symptoms. I mean, you take them too. Doctors had given them to me sometime back somewhere, you know, sometime that I needed them. And she said, you don't have one day of sobriety till you get rid of all those pills. And oh boy, did I fight for my right to take those. I was saying, you know, with alcohol, you can feel it, you know, your hands get numb and you get sexy, and but with pills, you don't feel it, you know. And so she said, well, it shouldn't be any trouble to quit then, should it? And I stern her anyway. I said, yeah. I said, no problem. And I did. I just quit those pills just like that, but I had to start drinking. And then I was going to AA meetings, you know, and I'd go with booze on my breath, and people would give this to me, and they'd say, keep coming back, honey. You know, I was like, good, I can't do this, because I loved AA by this time. So I go back to the pills, and I kind of bing back and forth, you know, there for a while. That was the most miserable drinking I have ever done. Well, I'll tell you, normal drinkers just, I don't know, I'm glad I was not a normal drinker. What boring, you know, you just get started, like foreplay, and that's it. You know, you just start in, and then you quit. And I was having like two, and then I would quit. And oh, it was horrible, it was frustrating, hated it. And then I think I got to quit this drinking, and then I'd get back on the pill. Anyway, to make a long story short, I did this for a while, and finally on the 4th of July, I went out and I got stinko. I just couldn't stand it anymore. I just got so drunk. Even my dog left me. She got up and went home. She just couldn't. My last person in my life, and she just was just total disgust. She just looked at me and went, oh, she went. And I put myself in a 30-day recovery program to get off both of them at the same time, and it was tough. I learned the word polyaddicted, and I had not realized, honestly, that I was addicted to those pills and to the alcohol and to everything, you know, and I had a rough time coming off all that stuff, and I went to a 30-day program, but I just want to say I'm so glad that I had AA before that and during that and after that, because so many things get you sober, but to stay sober, you know, this is the only thing that I know of that keeps me sober, and this AA does for me what alcohol does. It does for me. It fills me up. It makes me okay. It makes me solid. You people love me, so you care about me, and I get to care about you. I don't have to hide things from you. I don't have to lie. I don't have to have all these lives going on and all these costumes and play acting. This is what alcohol always did for me, is what little by little this program has come to mean to me. And, you know, the program had meant so much, and this is, I think, the people that I know that have stayed sober have been in AA. And every time you hear somebody go out, and you think about it, over my almost 14 years now, be 14 years July 9th, God willing, if I keep doing these things, think about it. Everybody says, I got away from meetings because of, you know, fill in the blank, and I got drunk. And everybody will say that, you know. So anytime I catch myself getting away from meetings, and I pass that along to you too, anytime you get away from that, we're on thin ice, you know, and I don't know exactly what happens here. I don't think it matters what we talk about here. I think our healing takes place on a different level. I could sit here and talk about real estate, I think, and we would stay sober because we love each other, you know, so much. Anyway, when I got sober, and I changed my sobriety date to July 9th after that because I got off of everything and started my little life in Alcoholics Anonymous, which in many ways has been more exciting than it ever was drinking. Started looking at a lot of things in my life and started taking inventories and started trying to get honest and starting to let go of all these secret lives I lived and let people know how I felt. And I found out that I had company, you know. I went to a women's meeting one time, and boy, I didn't want to go to a women's meeting. I mean, there's just women there. Who likes that? And I went because my sponsor told me to go. And I went in there, and I always had a resentment against women because I always thought women were always taken care of by daddy and then taken care of by their husband, and they just didn't understand. And I went to this meeting in Laguna Beach, and I walked in, and I thought, oh, God, there they are. You know, they were just these well-heeled. They were all dressed up and everything. And they started sharing around this table. I was very new at this time. And they started saying the most shocking things. I mean, these women could just run circles around me. I mean, they had done 10 times what I had ever done in every category. And by the time it got around to me, I felt very much at home in that meeting. And it allowed me to share for some reason, because they could share, I could share. You know, they had done those things. They'd done more than I had done. They'd outrun me in every category. And found out what maybe the beginning of what love means, that we love, you know, not in an obsessive way, but we love each other because we can share our lives with each other, because we can touch each other. I started looking at things like my income tax, and I started looking at things. So I was very much tied to Cleveland still in this cartoon strip, and I knew that when they talked in AA about you had to change everything, I started realizing they meant everything, not just everything, but everything. You have to start getting honest. And I was looking at my taxes, and I'm saying, this is fraud. In a word, you know, I'd go to jail for this. This is wrong. I was sending all my stuff to Cleveland, and the accountants were doing it, sending it back, and I used to get drunk, sign it, and what the hell, and send it in. This relationship with this man was getting worse and worse, and I was not getting my share of everything, and I knew it wasn't, but I had kids in college, and I didn't want to rock the boat. And finally, I knew that I had to do it. I remember Chuck always said, anything that comes between me and my program and me and my God has got to go, even if I don't want it to go. And I realized that I had to do that. So I knew I was walking into the lion's mouth, but I went up to Los Angeles, where we were doing an animated thing, and tried to get straight with this whole thing, and it wasn't working for a lot of reasons. I don't know if he had told stories and gotten himself into a corner. I don't know that I'll ever know the reasons for everything, but he finally told me, he said, I don't need you anymore, and he traded me in for 220s. That was a harsh one way back when, you know, when I first got sober, and I had accepted that pretty well with the aid of this program and all, and he finally said, you know, I don't need you anymore, and so I'm just going to drop you from everything. And I said, well, you can't do that. I'm going to start a lawsuit. And I did. I hired a big name, big attorney there in California, and started the lawsuit. And I remember Chuck used to say he had a man who cheated him out of about $500,000 one time, and everybody in AA said, Chuck, we'll go to court with you, and we'll help you get it back. And Chuck said, finally came to a point where he told this man, he said, Victor, the money means more to you than it means to me. You keep it. And I knew about this. And then Chuck went out and just earned all kinds of more money, you know, and it didn't matter. And I knew about this, but, you know, so often we say our case is different. And I went into a lawsuit at about 5 years of sobriety, and this was about the time I got Clancy as my sponsor also. And I remember my attorney said, the press will make you cry. And I said, no, I've already done my crying. I'm not afraid. And, boy, I had no idea what I was talking about. These lawyers are hired guns. They aren't paid to like you. And with all the guilt that an alcoholic automatically feels, me particularly, I went through depositions. I went through hell going through that thing. I'll tell you, it was the most awful period of my life. The attorneys, they did a motion to quash and a motion to demur and a motion of inconvenient form and a motion to fart around and a motion to spend 20 grand and an appeal and a continuance, and they just went on and on. And my income went from six figures to zero in one day. And I'll tell you, that's a harsh cut. It's really tough. And during that period of time, things started going. I mean, they went. And the houses went and the cars went, and I started typing for $6 an hour just to keep the light bill on, you know. Furniture went. Things started to go. And I moved out of Mission and moved into Laguna Beach in a little. I went from 2,800 square feet house to a little 640 square foot apartment, which for Laguna is pretty good size, actually. But yeah, I'd always wanted to move to Laguna, just not quite that way. And my lawyers taught me that the word conversion. You convert everything you own to cash and pay your lawyer. That's how that goes. And, yeah, the really awful thing, though, was this awful feeling that I was getting. I want to say that, you know, when I lost all that stuff, I had been sober long enough to know that I did not lose the things that I had come to value. I lost things. But when I started to lose the things that I had come to value, because I started waking up being afraid to face the day, I started waking up being so filled with fear. I started waking up being so angry at people and so wanting to retaliate and strike back. And all of a sudden it started occurring to me that the things that I valued were starting to go. Now, the people in AA walked with me every step of the way. They went to court with me. They helped me get papers together. You know, they were... I wondered what I would have done if I'd have gone through that drunk. You know, it would have been awful. But I started thinking, you know, gosh, if I just had a little social tranquilizers to get through these depositions, my thinking started to change. My serenity started to go, and the things I really started to value started to go. And I finally came back to old Chuck again. He used to say that if the whole world approves and your insides don't approve, you're not approved, and you've got to get right with the old sausage grinder in your heart, or it's not going to work. Or if the whole world disapproves and your inside says it's okay, it's okay. And there was part of me that said, this just isn't okay. And finally, my health started to go. I started getting some surgery and my gum surgery and all kinds of things because the stress was so intense on me and I had no money and we were on welfare. I was facing bankruptcy. And I'll tell you, I can't tell you how much a sponsor in this program means when you're going through those kinds of things. My life had changed totally. And finally, I came to the point where I just said, the money means more to you than it means to me. You keep it. And I had to walk away. I got most of my taxes paid. I got my our daughter got her education paid for, and he paid some of the lawyers, and that was it. And I just gave it up. Everyone said, if you'll hang in there for, you know, 5 years, you'll have, you know, your millions of dollars. And I said, in 5 years, I'll be dead. And I knew that I would. I knew that I couldn't stand it. That the stress was too much on me. Part of me still says, you know, you big chicken, you big coward. But part of me says, you know, when I put that down, my insides were okay. It said, oh, thank God, you know, it's over. And somehow I took back my life in a way. You know, now I have a life that I can share with God, and it's not controlled by other things, you know, that were there. I don't have to compromise like I did, and I can live my program a little bit better. I struggled along in AA, but, you know, with no car and no house and no credit and no anything, it's a little bit tough. So I finally called up my aunt in Athens, Georgia. I was getting pretty bleak there, and I told her, I said, you know, I need some help. And she said, well, why don't you come home? And so I did, just almost exactly 3 years ago. All I had left was just what was in my suitcases, and I packed up my suitcases and came home to Athens, Georgia. And I moved in with my aunt and uncle initially anyway, and they helped me. Got a little car, and I got a job working at the newspaper, and started off one more time, dusted off and started over again. And the AA in Athens is good. It's different than it was in California, but it's good. It's really good. And I've gotten very close to a lot of people in AA there. And I started back kind of like where I was. Started back in the South again. Started over again. And it's been a very interesting trip. I am now the social columnist of Athens, and I get to go to everything. I go to every reception and every opening and every theater. God, talk about a great job, you know. Part of that is because I'm a little bit of a recluse. If I didn't have that, I wouldn't get off my can and go out and do it. But as it is, you know, I get to attend everything. And I'm the business columnist for the newspaper now. And then a man in AA called me up after, just about a year ago now, and he said, I want you to go to work for me. And I was aggravated with the newspaper at the time, and I said, I don't know what it is you do, but I'll take it. What is it? What do you do? And he said, I sell real estate. And I said, well, I don't have a license, and I really don't have the money to get one. And he said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. And he did. So last June, I joined a real estate firm. I'm selling real estate now, and I'm still doing the columns for the newspaper. And I'll tell you, life is good. You know, I'm learning new businesses. It's like I just continue to keep being born into a new situation, and I flourish and I grow again. And it's all because of this program. It's all by the grace of God that these things happen. I need to quit. You worry so much about getting up here and then get up here, and there's just so much feeling and sharing in these rooms. I just, you know, it's the hard part is before. Once you get up here, it's fine. But I was thinking, my friend Louise came up to see me. She was in Athens, and she moved to Rome, and it was so nice to see her when she came, and she spent the night with me last night over at the hotel. And we were talking this morning about things, and here's Louise, who was in Athens, and she got her degree, and now she's in Rome and following her dream, and she's doing things. And here I am in Athens, Georgia, and I'm kind of following my dream, doing, you know, one of the best lives I've ever known, because I'm doing the things I know how to do and loving it and being out with people and doing those kinds of things. And we were talking about another friend who just got her PhD, and she's going to go out into the world. And she was, you know, we've all come, as Don Gates was talking, from this hopeless state of alcoholism and drugs and going through this hell. And as long as we stay sober, you know, we can just keep on walking. And we were talking about another friend who was, you know, no brighter, no smarter, no dumber, no anything than the rest of us, who just could not stay sober. And Louise and I were talking this morning, saying, you know, what is it? You know, I don't know what the difference is, except that I just hang on to this program and hang on to the people in this thing. Chuck used to have I start off Chuck, I'll end up with him, I guess, a poem that he used to quote on things. I guess I can close with that. He used to sit up in his house in Hilton Laguna Beach and look down on the Catalina Island and the ocean and all. And there was a lot of sailboats out there. And there's one little thing he used to talk about. He says, some ships sail east and some sail west by the self-same wind that blows. It's the set of the sail and not the gale that determines the way that it goes. You know, and that's my wish for you and my wish for me. You know, if we set our sail and we do these things, we can determine the way that it goes with God as the wind in our back. You know, there's hope here. There's hope in these rooms and there's love in these rooms. And if anyone is newborn, more I cannot wish you, don't quit before the miracle, because there isn't anything we can't walk through together sober. God bless you all, and thank you for letting me take part in this.